Hello everyone. Before we move on to the show, I want to quickly say that after 6 years, the Middle Earth Podcast 100th episode is coming up. So to celebrate that, we'll do a live recording in Beijing, April the 18th. It's a Thursday. We'll take a look back at the show, the up, then down, and the lesson of running a podcast. We'll also give a general bird-eyed view about how things have evolved in China cultural industry for the past years. I will be joined by Sam Davis, editor of the World of Chinese magazine, and Sarah Huang, who is a scriptwriter. We'll also have a time of exchange and, of course, a quiz with prizes to win. Truth be told, I'm really grateful to what Middle Earth has brought to my life. What started as a pet project allowed me to become my own boss and now to work on international co-production. So if you are a friend of the show, want to support us, are in Beijing, and you want to get a ticket to join us in the Hutong, you should find a link to youpay.cn in the podcast title description. Or you can find me on Twitter to get relevant info. I just can't copy-paste the link to every single episode description. Hope to see you there, and now on with your episode. So hi everyone, and welcome to Middle Earth, your source for insight into China cultural industry. Listen to those who are making a living by creating and distributing art or content onto the world's second biggest cultural market. I'm your host, Aladdin Faré from CCP, China Compass Production, a film production service in the Middle Kingdom. So if you have any cultural project related to China, like finding a talent for your next movie or do some location scouting, drop us an email at chinacompassproduction.com and see how we can help. Middle Earth is part of TWOC, the World of Chinese Podcast Network. The World of Chinese is a bi-monthly English magazine dedicated to Chinese language and culture. Every 2 months, the team at TWOC takes a modern theme and looks behind the headlines to uncover how contemporary issues affect Chinese society. The current issue, right here on the table, Something Old, Something New, takes a look at the problem with China aging society. And there are other fascinating stories about a Mars simulation camp in the desert of Western Qinghai and how big money and gambling are transforming the time-honored of pigeon racing. To learn more, go to theworldofchinese.com, link in the podcast description, to order your latest copy. I think everyone in this room has grown partly on Japanese animation, whatever side of the great world they lived on as a kid. China animation flourished in the 60s and won some international prize, but then for many decades was surpassed by Japan. Yet recently, the local industry has started to grow. To throw some number out there, in 2019, the feature animation film Neja became the third highest grossing film in the history of Chinese cinema. The size market will quadruple between 2013 and 2025. Chinese internet platform, in 2014, they had 150 million people watching animation, and it should be 400 million in 2022. So to talk about this, in this another burgeoning industry of China, three guests with me on this live event at the Great Outdoor in Beijing. So Lulu Hansen, hi.
Hello.
So you're born in China, raised in Europe, and educated in the US. You came back and you are now based in Beijing after nearly a decade. Here you are an IP creator, creative director, and producer. You have worked on film, TV, animation, and cultural diplomacy since you have completed your MFA in media production at the University of Southern California. Next to you, Delton Grant Jr. You are from Southern California, Los Angeles, and you started working in the animation industry in the US on films such as Cars or Shrek 2. In 2018, you moved to China to become a partner of Floating World Animation Studio in Beijing with various duties such as production management, pitch series bible creation, and director. And last, Ian, you graduated in the famous Beijing Film Academy, and since you have been working in film and animation industry as teacher, writer, director, creative producer, and executive for over 20 years. In those companies, you work in big studios such as Fosun and Disney, or smaller one like a Magic Dumplings. And recently, you are working as a general manager of Jupin Picture, where your work is all about developing and building brand new IPs. Well, first, briefly talk about the history of Chinese animation, its recent success, its future, both in terms of animated TV and feature film. Also, this is a public event. The last one we organized was actually in February 2019. Therefore, to share this conversation with an audience, I'm really happy about it. And of course, we'll take some Q&A from you guys. And then we'll finish with the usual quiz, and the winner will win the latest issue of TWOC, Something Old, Something New. Can we quickly jump back in time? Like, Ihan, can you tell us, like, when you were a kid, what animation, what cartoon were you watching on TV?
I remember Tom and Jerry and Doraemon. Those kind of animation is really, like, it opened my eyes to the animation world and the imagination and the common feeling of human being, the universal emotion touching. It's really impressive for me till today.
So are you saying that back in the day there were no Chinese animation on TV?
Yeah, no. When I was a kid, it's rare. Yeah.
Okay. Like in the 80s?
As early 80s.
Okay, yeah. Early 80s, okay. and then how can we compare then? Because you have a daughter.
Yes.
So what kind of animation... Okay, you're in the industry, so I guess maybe you know what's best for her to watch. But then what her and her classmate would be mainly watching then? What kind of cartoon animation will they see here in China?
So what I know, they really choose animation for themselves, by themselves. For example, Peppa Pig. And what the Paw one? The
Paw Patrol.
Paw Patrol, yes.
Okay, so...
That's what I remember mostly.
Okay, but those are all like international format, actually.
Yes.
Okay, well, so much for Chinese animation, I guess.
And I think people all know the Boonie Bears, right? The most famous one. But yeah, I see people laughing. Yes, have to say this is really good IP from the point of IP. But for my daughter thinks this is scary. I mean, they look scary, so I have no idea how to really guide her to watch them. I think it's more like a boy friendly.
Okay, then in today's industry and market, in Chinese animation, I feel there is basically, from my understanding, two main things, which is like feature film going in the cinema and animation going for young kids. Can you guys explain a little bit about this market difference?
You know, this is a problem I've been thinking about a lot because before I started doing my current feature film development, which ties back into my previous experience, but not quite so directly. Before that, I was doing series development, and I had been attached to or worked on a few series. I think right now, whenever we have marketing meetings or we have these presentations by very hardworking, earnest, data-gathering younger people, and I see their PPTs on the screen and everyone's analyzing, and like, oh, well, this film made this much money, this is a very strong IP, I feel like there's a disparate... fun set, right? There's a kind of looseness. Because on the one hand, we have these very, very profitable movies like Nuojia that come along really not very often. The vast majority, actually, of animation films don't make money. Or actually, films, period, don't make money. So when people say, oh, but look at that, look at the Boonie Bears, you know, 100th film that the Boonie Bears IP has produced, I think, of course, we need to learn from those and those success stories, but they're not applicable if you're just starting out, or even if your company has kind of achieved a middle grade stability, because if you don't have comparable IP, if you don't have, for example, Nuojia, that's not a totally original take. That is based on Feng Sheng Yan Yi or Feng Sheng Bang even earlier, right? These are classical texts where people already know something about the character. There is a kind of cultural lineage there, and that's by calculation. This is why everyone went into this crazy rush to make. Now we have, Erlang Shen is coming along. We had another Nuojia, which I personally preferred, actually. There's a tiptoeing, right, and trying to find that sweet spot. Because as you said, Aladdin, there is seemingly a kind of polarity between animation for very young children on the series front that tends to be more education-focused or not, but then the parents complain about it, or these mega money-making golden geese that we're trying to get once every few years. And it's kind of a lopsided distribution. So I think, in short, there is a segmentation, there's a fragmentation of the market, and there are very few properties that can really link all of them together.
Yeah, so are you saying that the two markets, let's say, are completely separated? Because apparently the feature animation, like most of the people going to watch them are really young adults.
Yeah,
as
so,
kids
right,
don't have the time to just go to the cinema.
Exactly. You have young adults, you may have some young, cooler parents. We can do a Venn diagram, an overlay diagram analysis of this. But yeah, I mean, I would say... Even age difference-wise, I was talking to some contemporaries at really big platforms doing series for kids, and now those boundaries are getting so infinitesimally fine, right? We're getting down to 1 or 2 years between different genres, even within the same production line. That was an eye-opener for me last month to learn that, whereas before, there seemed to be more crossover. Yeah.
So, Dalton, like, what kind of series are you developing in your company?
If you're usually for kids' shows, you have to do things that are marketable. So, in other words, there's not enough capital to happen while you're doing the series, because the nature of how the capital flows when you're making a show is piecemeal based on shuttles and deadlines and hitting certain milestones, if you will. In the States, it's not like that. You get your budget and you're set for that year or that season. So you could rotate your artists and whoever as needed. Also, it's more writer-driven in the States. Here, it's writer-driven, but the writers aren't experienced in TV. So there's issues with that as well. then you also have to appease the investor to keep those milestones in place with the proper funding to keep going. I don't do anything to tell the investors what we're not going to be able to do. I'm very realistic about this is what we are trying to do, this is what we're trying to say, and if you can help us get to that point, this is what I need you to do for me. And if we can work together, then I can make concessions. So there are things in our shows, like right now working on a kid series where the character gets shrunk down to bug size, and she's now having to experience life through these bugs. And these bugs are like her, but they have special gifts and talents, which she doesn't. And so she learns to use them as well as they learn to use her knowledge of the real world, of the bigger world around her, to grow. So technically, when you're dealing with kid shows, the key is like making sure that the kid gets to walk away with something, like a survival kit. And that's kind of the point of all story in the first place. You tell a story so that you are left with something you know not to do or to do.
Jan, previously during our pre-interview, so you told me that now you're like trying to develop strong IPs, and it seems like it's something which is becoming more and more important now. Can you just please share what is your experience in this?
Yeah, sure. When we are looking for the material we are going to develop and put them into the cinema, we always bump into these questions that is that worthy for people to really get out of their room and take maybe 1 hour traffic and spend a lot of money on dinners and really find someone to enjoy the movie together. And it is really important for us to keep making those IP so make it a brand. Means that in certain of time, for example, every end of year, they find this is like more like a ceremony to call out my friend. We spend the same experience to the cinema and see the same brand, the movies. It's less about the content, more about the brand for us. So yeah, that's what we learn and how we pick the material. See how can we make it really a brand? Can we keep providing the same value and the same characters? What happened in their lives? So it's like in certain of time you get to see your old friend in the theater, and they are growing as you. Yeah, something like that.
How does it work? Like, you jump into the whole history of Chinese folktales and you try to pick up like new stories that will then live on every year with a new movie from that same folktale?
I can come from anywhere. Yeah, from novels, from TV series, maybe just from a script or from idea. But we need to have some rules to tell us what is the standard. How can we decide whether it's worthy to make a brand to keep put them into the theater or not?
So far, like, what are the kind of stories that people in China prefer to watch? Like, is there like some kind of metrics and you're like, ooh, this will hit a sweet spot and no, this is not going to work? Or is it a surprise every time?
Yeah, it's a really good question because people, they don't know what they like before they really see it. So for the investor, the producers, trying to play safe, to go to the big IPs like traditional Chinese heroes, but that have their problem. It's this: you can't own the IP, right? Everybody have the right to make it, and also you have to be really creative too. If you go too far, people can't really relate to it. But if you get too close, then you have nothing new for people. That is really a challenge. But I for me, we are looking for really something emotionally can communicate to the audience, especially for the Z generation.
Yeah, because you guys were like nodding and laughing, so it seems like it's an everyday problem.
Yes, I think the three of us probably have all faced interim variations and striations of these issues and questions. But to Yan's point, I was nodding a lot because, for example, I was thinking about, in context of what you're saying, Nojad is a very successful hit. The second one, which I personally prefer, didn't make nearly as much money, but it was a lot bolder, creatively speaking. But later I thought about it, and I think what really sold the first Noja for me, even though I didn't love it, was its ethos. It took this character that already had a very rebellious backstory. Everybody knows, and if you grew up in this cultural context, something about this character. There are certain things in the story that they don't go into, but we all know happened. He tried to kill his father. He, you know, his master had to actually punish him. He had to be literally reborn and reformulated from non-human or non-godlike remains, but from a lotus flower, which is an embodiment of Buddhism or Buddhist principles. Weirdly, in that late Ming kind of mixture of all kind of religion context, to become acceptable and become a god, right? To become a legitimized god. And what I think a lot of people responded to in that film version is his ethos, which is, I get to decide my fate. And who doesn't identify with that sense? You know, this desire for agency, this desire to be seen within your own context. So we can take a very classical IP character or a known entity, but it's not exactly putting a new spin on it, but finding that magical ingredient that makes people really resonate with it. In this case, not even this generation only, but I think cross-generationally, this desire to be given some space to express ourselves and to choose and not feel like everything has been preordained. I think that really latched onto a really wonderful, wonderful ethos.
Yeah, to double down, I think what you said is really true, especially for modern Chinese kids. They live in a different China. So the old stories were, you're destined to do this thing. But like now, you make your destiny depending on what you can do. And I think that's why the Nudge of made sense, the first one, that is.
Yeah, I really agree with this, the Noda thing, right? How we study a lot from that movie. I hate to say that that's probably called dream, right? It's everybody want to control their destiny. It is impossible. But we sometimes just have to play the liar to tell them that it is possible.
Well,
it's ironic. I know it's ironic, but you can't give them a hope. Give yourself the same hope, actually. Yeah. So that's called share the same dream, maybe.
One last remark, and then we'll keep moving on.
Okay. Just briefly to that, you're making me think a lot. I had the good fortune some years ago of speaking with an elderly philosopher. And at the time, I was developing a lot of kid series and stuff specifically for school-age children. So, and I was grappling with this question. Like, if we, in our series, in our, not necessarily films, which can go a little bit darker, but in terms of, or more problematic, but in series, we often, through the color palette, through the storylines, through the kind of children we characterize, you know, whatever, they're animals or humanistic, anthropomorphic, we present a relatively idealized world. This is the way we should act toward each other. We should be considerate. We should be kind. Not necessarily in a preachy way. But anyway, one of the questions I asked her was, is that kind of lying to children? Because I felt this moral responsibility, right? I mean, we as adults, once we've lived long enough, know that the world has a lot of issues. There's a lot of contentious beliefs about how we should be as a humanity, as, you know, even in our communities. So is it in fact kind of dishonest and irresponsible for us as content makers to sort of plant, seed their childhood environments with these idealistic visions of the world? Is that wrong? Anyway, so she thought about it and she said, no, it's not wrong, because it's only by presenting them with these alternatives, which are by no means definitive of how the world is, that we really give them a choice. So I agree with you that I think it is, there's an aspirational quality to the Noda message, and maybe we'll get smacked down by reality, but I think that little space, that alternative space for them to dream differently and to think differently is still meaningful.
Moving on from the field of philosophy to the grim place of government policies. I'm half joking because I'm French, and basically France has like strong policies to help its local creators. Like, and other without those policies, like, I think we would just be smashed down by Netflix and the big studio from Hollywood. Like, this is what happened in Italy. So I'm just wondering, in China, are there like some policies like regarding helping creators in their animation studio, or like some town that want to become like the mecca of animation in China? Have you heard such kind of policies or help? Or maybe it just doesn't exist. Maybe no one thought about that. And then it's just like a free-for-all market type.
I mean, the market right now is pretty wide open. And when you get pushback like from CCTV, like from my experience with them, it's more like don't rock the boat type stuff. But my philosophy has always been like, even at Disney, I felt, well, they dominate everything. So I can't go in there with any idea and say, hey, I want to do princesses this way. I'm going to mess up your princess line by making them all ghetto and whatever. Even if I wanted to, they wouldn't let me. And they would blacklist me out of the business, and that would be the end, right? But so to be creative there, though, the nature is like, well, here's this box. And then you say, okay, once you get past the point that there is boundaries, your creativity comes from experience. What are these characters experiencing? And can I make that believable? I've worked on a ton of shows I didn't agree with, but I can still work on them because I'm going to add that magic, the feeling that I can relate to this character by making them feel real, like they have wishes, desires, dreams, and they get shattered as well.
Okay, and then so I would guess that CCTV has a more conservative approach to things. But then because on the other side, you have like all those giant platform, iQIYI, Tencent Video, right, Youku. I would guess that those guys would be a little bit more open to Ghetto Princess or they do the same kind of content as CCTV.
They're very different in that CCTV is, it's not for profit per se. You know, it's like if it's state run, it's not a profit tier. So it's like the wrong way to think about it. And when you say the servers like of IG or Tencent or whoever, it's like they're making profit off of data. So like that's a different brain. Like of course, and that's got its own parameters.
The type of show would be completely different.
Exactly. So if you're going to be on, you know, like we in America, we had public access. That's where we had our Mr. Rogers and our Sesame Street. That's where that came from for us. But we also had the big brands, right? And I think they both can coexist if you're doing the right thing. You know, it just depends. And like she said, I think you just need to work with them. Like, that's the key.
Moving on, because also I would like to open the floor as soon as possible. I'm just wondering, like, what are the main issue in your job? Like, if you had a magic wand and you would like to fix something in your field, like regarding, do you think the main of your hardship are like in the question of lacking talents or lacking money or lacking markets? Like, where do you think so far, like the main problem that you face during your daily job?
If I have that thing, I really want to know what the audience need. Really, it's hard to analyze those data because data doesn't tell you really what the real need. And data is like a backward. You put something there and you see what people's reaction. I mean, you have to really put a lot of effort into that data to analyze that what they really want. And what they want and what they need are different things. And what you should meet, do you meet their want more or their needs more? For me, is a big question because when we're talking about building brand, it's really we see that not a masterpiece. We don't see this even anything. It's like a film, a movie. We more like to call it a product. So you have to know who is your user and what they want and what they need. That's for me.
But can you give a quick example of what they want and what you think they should need?
Go back to the merger thing, right? Do they really think they have this possibility to change or control their fate or not? You can really go either too far or left or right, but miss the point. The point is really tricky, I think, yeah.
I believe you're next in line.
But maybe you're fully happy in your job and there's nothing to change.
I've never been fully happy working ever.
Can he use a magic wand on himself?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's a tough... There's so many different problems, but the nature of how I see conflict is different. It's a young market. And I guess if I could wave my magic wand, I'd like to fast forward to see where this market goes, because then that'll tell us more than what we need to do.
That's such a good answer. Wish I could have pinched it. That's a very hard question. How powerful is this magic wand? How many people can we affect? Can we like go back in time? Like what is the parameter of this tool?
Well, let's say it's the Aladdin's lamp, so everything is okay.
Okay, well, I'm going to be very much more hippie than my counterparts here. I would say if we were that powerful, Aladdin, your lamp, I would wish for all of our audiences, regardless of age, background, demographic, whatever, etc., but to retain some kind of joy and openness to joy throughout their lives. And I don't mean this from a high-handed kind of way. I mean genuinely, like whether it's because, oh, the slice of lemon today next to my tea is really beautiful, like just that little moment, or whether it's something deeper and more ineffable, right? But to have that little window stay open throughout their lives, no matter what happens to us as human beings. Because as a content creator, when I'm pitching, when I'm trying to get support for a certain project, or I'm trying to pitch to a customer base, I find sometimes the hardest thing to overcome is not even to do with the relative quality of what I'm pitching, what I'm trying to sell, if you will, but a relative openness to seeing things from a slightly more colorful, innocent, joyous point of view. And when I find that block exists, it doesn't matter what I've got. Even if I fit all of their marketing parameters, it's always a no, or it's just a kind of a spinning your wheels, going nowhere situation. Whereas I think also just holistically for improving our quality of life, if we're able to retain, and I've met some 20-year-olds who are very jaded and dead inside, and that makes me so sad. if we could have this magical lamp that makes us, all of us, retain that ability to see and seek out and enjoy that joy, I'd be very happy, regardless of my job and my occupation.
And now I think we can open the floor to the audience, if they're not too shy. The rule is, please state your name, what you do, so that you know we know who you are. And please ask a real question, don't make a comment, because after we'll have a gather around party. If you want to criticize what they've done, then you can, but please, no need on the...
Okay, my name is Bowen Tan. I'm right now a freelance animator, and right now I'm working on a project that I decided to submit it to the Tencent, you know, the youth animation director program. Because I have been in a studio before, and then they make a children animation, kid animation, just like what you did before, But most of the Chinese kids shows are about, you know, telling the kids the informative information instead of, you know, letting the kids to have something imaginative adventure, just like what you mentioned before. And because of the policy reasons, and also for the broadcast, also for the censorship to a certain instance, and also because of the marketing situation right now with the growing number of the, you know, the kid education industry. So do you think this kind of thing could fit into the international market?
Didn't quite grasp the core of the question.
From my understanding, your question is like, kids' content in China are like so focused on education type that it will just not go abroad, and it's just going to be boring.
I see. Well, I would say that even internationally, there are a lot of great programs that have a range of soft to hard curricula that do teach us things. You know, they're delivered with more or less art, if you will, depending on the show. And that itself is not a disqualifier. But I would say that, I mean, we always talk about this problem, 如何让中国的内容走出去? How can we make Chinese content exportable? And I think coming back to something Dalton and Ian and I were talking about before we started a panel, it's not so much these hardline format differences. It's the soul of the story. How do you tell it? Who are the core characters? What are their main struggles? When kids watch this show, regardless of cultural boundaries that may or may not exist, what are they getting out of it? What is their experience afterwards? Do they feel empowered? Do they feel smarter? Do they feel they have they could have better friendships? Do they have feel like, oh, a window has been opened in my mind? I think those are the things that really make a difference. And then if we're going to talk about distribution and international markets, that gets quite technical, because you're talking about, you know, what kinds of blocks of countries or cultures are more or less receptive to the kind of content we're making if we're using certain kinds of semiotics. For example, you know, earlier Soviet animations, or actually even coming back to your first question to Yi'an, I remember watching Da Nao Tian Gong on TV when I was a child in the 80s. And I remember watching FNT, you know, the Nasruddin Effendi stop motion series, which was, I think, also made by Shanghai Animation. They were beautiful, you know, and those things actually, I think, would travel because they have a kind of cultural confidence. And I'm sorry, I'm getting off topic here. But so to sum up, to answer your question, I don't think it's these sort of format differences, but it's really about how you're telling, what story are you telling, how are you telling the story, who is your central character, do children really relate to it? Is it coming? What is the main impetus behind the creation of this content? I think all of those things play into the larger equation.
Make it fun.
Yes, and cute and sweet and fun.
Hi, my name is Matthew. I produce dubbing projects. To expand on the previous question that was more content-based, my original question was about international distribution and whether you would see animation having an edge over live action or documentaries for international distribution, or also this is twofold. This fold is like animation having an edge or not, and also I remember watching on Wish Dragon, the latest really recent release, the credits being co-produced with Disney, Netflix. Do you see other ways than co-production to actually having international distribution?
Yeah, there is one thing, because even in the United States, animated films in general make way more per capita for what you're spending. You make way more in return. But that comes from the amount of products after something is made that you could use. I mean, Avatar was a good live-action animated, mostly animated blend, but you could do so much more in the ancillary product market. So when you say...
So you mean like video games, derivative toys?
Toys, lunchboxes, hats, t-shirts, dolls, board games, and what have you, comic books. Like, you could just make a ton of other merch. And that IP goes much further. So for film, it's not based on those same parameters. A big film distribution group is more worried about when they sell it into other markets, the ticket price, and then after if it's streamed again and things like that. So it's a little bit different, and it that means that there's less content that you can create after it. They're not going to make a whole lot of video games of Friends. So I would just, if you do go into animation, just know that there's more than one avenue you could sell this product, and that's about sales in general.
I think the question was more about, like, is animation maybe the one easy way for China to tell its story around the world, and easier than movie and documentary?
I'd say yeah, because I always think back to Hayao Miyazaki's, that his studio, he didn't make this one, but Grave of the Fireflies.
Yeah,
And I think about it because in that film, they never speak about war. There was a war happening, but they never speak about war. And they don't say who was fighting. You don't know what country you're really in, even though we know we're in Japan. They don't say it was an American bomber, but you have the shape and silhouettes of bombers. And the children are hyper-real. They're not real kids. They look super cartoony. In fact, all of his designs look the same, right? Now, I think the beauty of that story is that it's the symbol of a child. It's not any specific child. And I think when you put an actual child in that same role, it would change the way people view it. And I think it was accepted by the world because it was about children in war, period. And that symbol is very strong. And I don't think if you did it live, it would have the same impact.
Found that film to be similarly moving and very subtle. It was really focused on the children's experiences. And it actually reminds me, going slightly off topic on your question, but another Japanese film that I think has a lot of appeal, although it's so very, very, very Japanese, is an old 1980s film called Tanpopo. I don't know if everyone's seen this. So it's loosely structured around humans' relationship with food. And we kind of follow this widow who's trying to start a successful ramen restaurant. And I bring this up because so much about it, and I don't have more than a passing understanding of Japanese culture, but so much about it is so Japanese. You can tell, you know, just all the mannerisms, all the different contexts for embarrassment, for pride, for greed, all these things. But somehow they were able to communicate in this very universal way, and they don't explain. There are no subtitles to say, okay, foreign person, this is what we mean. It's just presented very naturally. And I think that actually helps to cut down the amount of anxiety that a new audience might feel, that we are really just seeing whatever it is that we can pick up as human beings. So if we can go back to a more genuine, authentic child's experience of something, you can deal with a very complex topic, like in the movie that Dalton mentioned, The Grave of the Fireflies. It's very heavy. It's beautifully made, but it's so focused on the experience of these children without all these layers of context, per se, that make it really universally relatable. So that's a really good example. But I would argue that if you were to, even if the format is animation, but we have that top-down talking down to kids or a planned idea of what children should and shouldn't like, it's not going to resonate as well. And to your second question regarding international distribution, this is not something that I'm an expert in. However, in terms of foreign sales, the market model used to be that you would have pre-sales. So before you even make your film, you would go to these markets, you would pitch it, you would have your backers, and then part of your financing could actually come from your distribution agent who would sell it for you. And then that would actually allow you to get the film made. In China, I haven't followed it too closely in recent years, but the model has traditionally more been like, we financed it, we're doing it ourselves, we've gotten the best teachers, local and abroad, to come on board, and we've already made it, and then we take it to market. And then in that situation, if you're taking this ready-made product, there's no room for input from people who may understand the international market better than you do, if that matters to you at all. And then you're just kind of trying to push this thing, like, hey, we've already made 52 episodes. Can you just buy it and distribute it? In which case, you're cutting down your revenue possibilities, because then you're looking at people who are looking for content to stream in hotels or planes, et cetera, as well as maybe theatrical distribution. So to my knowledge, that gap between the pre-sale model, where you have more voices come in to, you could say, meddle or influence your outcome, vis-a-vis the we've done this in our workshop and we're ready to sell it, can you just please distribute and make money for us? There's still that gap there, as far as I know.
So when you're dealing with distribution in general, and you have to have money to do that level of marketing and make sense of the money that's already in place, because it's an investment. And that's a very different brain than that of why you make the animation as an artist. but they both have to work together. And the unique issue in China is distribution tends to want to sell abroad, but doesn't know how to link to the voices. The other issue of that is if you get those too many cooks in the kitchen too soon, you won't get anything worth selling. So you have to balance this issue of what you mentioned earlier was a standard. There has to be some type of standard. Like when you see Disney and Disney TV, you know the standard of what's generally going to be on there, regardless if it's princesses, little boys, about recess, about anything. It doesn't matter. You just assume that that's the case. And we've built these standards. So that doesn't exist yet. Once it does, then we could make more sense of the market models.
Yeah, I guess this is why Kung Fu Mulan was not that great. That movie came out a few months ago. Okay. Moving on. Does anyone else have a question?
I'm Elaine, and I'm a writer who covers the mainland entertainment industry. And I want to ask, do you guys work in any animation co-productions? Because China is having very bad relationship with all over the world, the geopolitical tensions. Did it affect any of the co-productions you have been involved in?
I actually looked into this issue previously because on a couple projects I was doing, we were interested and open to, and I used to work with organizations that had really good incentives, you know, in different places that had really good animation and children's content professionals we wanted to work with. And we thought, wouldn't it just save a lot of money if we could just do this? And I actually spoke to the authorities involved even while this was going on. And I'm going to share with you their official answer with me in this private conference room. It's nothing sensitive. I think what they say is true, actually. The more complex, shall we say, the exterior other arenas of engagement are, the more important it is for us as storytellers, content makers, and in my case, little people, to engage with other regular people. So that's what they said, and I think it makes a lot of sense.
I mean, co-productions have struggled, but for not the reasons that you're talking about. I think a lot of it has to do with the nature of how China views itself and how the Western world has been downplaying China's growth. And it's a sad commentary, but it's a truth that the Western world doesn't respect it the same way it should or could. And so you're fighting against those narratives. Now, there are people who see China as a profit-seeking space. So usually those co-productions are here to make money. And their issues that they have is, well, we're right because we've been doing it longer. And that's not always the case. But that's where the production creatively starts to fall apart. Then you also have Chinese ABC, like American-born Chinese people, who these larger productions in America use to do that bridge. The only issue with that is they don't agree with the Chinese people from China mainland. So that becomes an issue. And then the big market, whether it's Disney or whoever, they don't know who to trust at that point. So then things just fall apart again. So there's all these miscommunications going on. And that's where the co-production problems are coming from.
When I was in Disney, we make a co-production TV animation series. From my understanding, I think co-production, you can put yourself in a middle way. And for Chinese audience or Chinese creators, they may think it is too nice. I heard this many times. You don't go Disney way. It's just, they're nice, but that's the shortcoming. They are nice. You have to be true or be real or really deep down to find something in our people's heart. I understand what they are talking about. You don't want to be pretty and nice or right. Even right is let me put it this way. Right doesn't sell.
And I would, as a last parting thought, I would ask why you want this project to be a co-production. Because as the other two have touched upon, there are a lot of challenges in getting it creatively, financially, executively, et cetera, done, you know, even to go through the process. And I would say that actually for animated series is a bit easier than for film in general, because film is this whole other can of worms. But the question I would always ask is, why would you want to make this a co-production? Are the benefits worth it? Worth all the challenges? And for me, if the talent is right, if the story is right, there's no reason not to explore it, because you can get a lot of good back and forth. But I don't think every project should be a co-production just for crass reasons of market access. You're going to fail, and it's going to lose money, and it's going to be a terrible, heartbreaking experience that make you doubt the existence of anything in the world. But if you have the right project and you have good reasons for making a co-production, there's no reason to not try. I've not received any official word that we shouldn't try to do so, and I still think it's important for us to try.
Hi, my name is Kevin. I'm just a teacher, but this is a question as a cartoon lover. I grew up in the cartoons of the 90s and the early 2000s, where it's mostly 2D animation. In the film industry, or I guess even TV series, would 2D animation ever make a comeback?
2D is not dead. It's not coming back from anything, right? It really isn't. Like Claws is a beautiful example on Netflix. That's all 2D, but it has a new lighting pass that makes it look like it's 3D. But it's all hand-drawn. Every frame is hand-done. Most 3D films and feature for animation, children in particular, all the boarding is done by hand. So every frame is planned out through drawing and that craft. So no, it's definitely not dead. Now, the end product is harder to do, because it's harder to convince this new group of kids to draw more. The kids today are thinking completely different. So there's not enough skilled labor to do it on a mass scale. Now, in that regard, I've always thought about this for a long time as a 2D guy that moved into 3D. I used to get worried that the computer is just going to take our jobs and that type of thing. And to some degree it is, but it's also an elitist attitude in a way. Remember when Disney, at its heyday, had the 9 old men. They wrote the Illusion of Life book, and every animator around the planet reads this book and uses their skill sets. It was 9 guys. That's a very small group of people, and not everybody can work for Disney worldwide. So there was limited people who could actually do the work. And the one beautiful thing about the computer in this regard is that everybody can actually do work on something like Toy Story. You don't need to know how to draw per se, but you still have to understand the animation language. So someone who loves cartoons, you are allowed to work in that industry also, and there's way more workers now. So I don't want to go backwards in that sense. I think more of us should be trying to do this craft, but it's harder to make the argument. How do you train people to do this traditionally or classically?
I come upon this question sometimes when making, first of all, a stylistic decision. Should this piece be 2D or 3D? And it is very much the fashion to make things in 3D. A lot of younger people seem to prefer it. It signals modern, advanced, trendy of this time. And when I found that, at least in terms of character design and earlier visual development, 3D is actually quite hard to do beautifully. You can, of course, have this elite group of people, probably the people you work with, who can do that. But for, again, my anecdotal experience is from a vast part of the market, it's really hard to find highly skilled people with taste and subtlety to do 3D visual development. I had to come up against this problem time and time again recently on a project where we had to design this main character. And 2D, he's fine. He's cute, he's beautiful, he's well-proportioned, the colors are very soft. And even with our relatively skilled animators or designers trying to turn him to 3D, there were a lot of problems that we then saw exist in 3D that are not problems in 2D. And I would say aesthetically, ideally we get to a place where 3D loses some of this automatic luster because it's not always used well. It's a tool like anything else, just like 2D is. And in fact, there are series, as I'm sure you guys know, where it's 3D in terms of the mechanics of it, but it looks like 2D because we still miss that aesthetic, or a more children's book kind of aesthetic. It's more friendly to that kind of approach. So I'm hoping we'll get to a point where this new technology, we can use it and have fun with it and be excited about it, absolutely, but it is a tool like anything else. And we have to select what is the best tool, what is the best style for telling the story we want to tell with the effect that we want to do. Because you can look at some cheaply made kid series, for example, that are in 3D. And when I look at the production companies, they've done solid work. It's not that they're unprofessional, but there's a lack of refinement, I would say, to how the shadows hit the face, how the lighting interacts with the angles of the body. And sometimes characters end up looking very similar because roundness tend to be easier in 3D designs than in 2D. In 2D, we can do very exaggerated proportions and angular things. But once you start to render that into a 3D model, it looks awful. Or it just doesn't make sense. You know, you look at it from this angle, it's like, oh yeah, that looks like our IP character. And then you subtly shift the angle and it just looks totally unrecognizable.
For me, actually we are making animated feature. every time when we come to the point that we decide whether it's 2D or 3D, the biggest thing is that we cannot really find the 2D talents enough, 2D talents, really, really. And but when we are making our movies, we are looking for the 2D feel, look and feel, basically look and feel. So we are going to do, like, say, 2.5. Yeah, it's less about the two. It's more about the feeling. What feeling you give the audience? Because to be honestly, 3D works is everywhere. It's really easy to make that look cheap.
Can you give an example of a 2.5 animation film? Because I have no idea.
It's like you really make it in 3D, but you make it look and feel like 2D. You have
But do you have an example of a movie we should watch?
Luca. Okay. Luca, the new Pixar film. Very much.
Ghost in the Shell, the new
Netflix series Ghost in the Shell. Exactly. Yeah. There's a ton. I mean, they're out there and they're coming.
All right, then we're going to move to the last part of the show, my favorite, the quiz. So I will ask you a few questions. Well, if you know the answer, you will buzz in with your name, and the winner of the quiz will win the latest issue of The World of Chinese, something old, something new, just right there. It's okay. If you don't win the quiz, you can just go buy yourself a copy after. Okay, so first question. Can any of you tell me what is the name of the first Chinese animated feature film?
Arrow.
Yi, please tell me.
Oh, he knows.
You can tell the name in Chinese. It's okay.
Arrow Princess?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. It was made in 1941. Yep. It took them 3 years and 200 artists to complete the 73-minute version. You can actually find it on archive.org. There is a link on Wikipedia. Second question. What is the longest still-running Chinese animation TV shows?
Lulu Xiong Chumua? I mean, Boonie Bears?
No.
I'm just guessing. Lulu, Da Chou Erzi?
No, it's not that.
E, Big Big Wolf?
Big Big Wolf? Si Yang Yang? Yes, indeed.
What? That's still on? Jesus.
I have no idea.
Yeah, right.
Those are the big three, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there is a third and last question, so I guess someone is going to win the quiz.
Already.
But at least some people, maybe they can try to, you know, lose with some style at least. Okay, so we're going to play Let's Guess the Number. So we all know that Neja in 2019 became like the third highest grossing film in the history of Chinese cinema. Nevertheless, can you tell me the percentage of the sales internationally? Like, what's the percentage? Like, they made a bunch of money, and on that bunch of money, what's the percentage of money they made on the international market? I guess each of you can just say a random number.
I'm going to go with 2.
Okay, 2%. Dalton?
I'd say 20.
20%, okay.
It's less than 1, I guess.
Point 2. The price is right.
Well, actually, yeah, the answer is roughly 1%. So you win the quiz with 3 points. Congratulations. Wow, that was a killing. Like, wow. on that note, we'll wrap up the show. So thank you guys for your time. Big shout out to Jen Poland and Kevin Geiger, who helped me to find some of the guests. And thank you, dear listeners, who stay until the end credits. Middle Earth is produced by China Compass Production, your production service in the Middle Kingdom. For example, if you need to find talent for your next documentary in China or import your YouTube videos onto Chinese platform, drop us an email at chinacompassproduction.com and see how we can help. Let me remind you that Middle Earth is part of TWC, the World of Chinese podcast network. If you want to know more behind the headlines, go to theworldofchinese.com and order your latest copy. Today's episode was produced and edited by Alain Faré.
Research by Jadra Nurpis.
Music by Sean Calvo.
Distributed by the World of Chinese Podcast Network. I guess you already all have a podcast app, but if you don't want to miss the coming show or listen to the old ones, you can subscribe to our feed. And if you like this show, please consider sharing it with a friend. Always help with the algorithm. And Origo. Hope to see you next time and stay safe. Bye-bye. Oh, another guy working in animation. Great.
Are you intimidating us, Alana? Is it going to be a quiz? What is this quiz?
Well, I can see someone is not listening to my show. Looks like our listener are still doing their dishes.
Yeah, all very committed to their workout.
Yeah, for sure.
So, since you're still here, if you want to learn more about Chinese society, culture, history, and language, you should go to theworldofchinese.com or find us on WeChat, and you'll find an amazing array of award-winning, in-depth, original reporting on China and amazing videos and podcasts too.
All right. Well, until the next issue then.